Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What other way to go into a podcast like this than with a slightly evil laugh, Josh Brown? How are you doing over there?
I'm all right, Scott Telford. But you know what? It was a strange old week last week, full of highs and occasional low, but it was generally good to be back. You know, I'd forgotten about the sort of physical ailments of working. You know, I was so worried about, obviously I was off for mental health reasons. I was worried about coming back and then protecting my mental health. I just forgot how tiring work it is. And that's coming from the perspective of someone who had it very easy last week, because fortunately I have the best boss in the world, Scott Telford, who was looking after me very much so.
Thank you very
much. But even on that kind of reduced workload, I got the work eye twitch straight away. I don't know if anyone else who especially works on screens all day is familiar with the eye twitch. That came back after 4 months of just it not appearing at all. Day one, pretty much by lunch, the eye twitch was back.
I thought that's more like related to like hydration and stuff, isn't it? I know it's a stress thing too, but I'm sure you can like mitigate it or slightly push it back by just drinking loads of water.
Too personal.
You do actually have a water bottle. I don't have anything right now.
I wee like a racehorse, man. I'm going all the time because I'm doing nothing but drinking water.
More wee than Nintendo, carry on.
Offset headaches and eye strain. I don't know what it is, man. Maybe I should go to the doctor's for it. I don't know. But anyway, I just thought it was very funny that I've had 4 months of, you know, luxury eye treatment, and then I come back for half a day, and it's like the eye twitch returns.
That's your brain going like, right then. Let's see what you're telling me to do now.
But no, it was lovely getting back in the studio with you, and I just kind of wanted to take a minute right now because I forgot to thank a few people last week.
Okay.
I forgot to thank you for being the best. I forgot to thank everyone who filled in on the podcast. You know, I'm probably going to miss some names, but I know Strong was on here, Stevie was on here, Ewan was on here, Cy was on here, probably a bunch more that I don't even know about, but thank you so much to them as well for you know, jumping in and doing an exceptional job and probably making me redundant at the end of the year.
It takes an army, my friend.
And that was pretty much it. I also wanted to say thank you to everyone who was so lovely last week and messaging me and being really supportive. The support was incredible, it was, and it was really touching. So thank you, as in Scott Telford, and thank you, as in everyone else who's featured on this podcast.
Honestly, dude, like, it is all you. Like, I mean, the amount that you've done, like, I was telling you last week, like, I'm extremely proud of you for getting stuck in. Like, we're tackling this very much together. Like you said, like, I'm in charge of your stuff, but we've always worked together on things anyway. But yeah, I always wanted to try and give you, like, the best return to work possible.
Bless you
getting absolutely stuck in. Like, you did multiple news videos, the podcast and everything. We talked about it at the start of last week, but it's been a hell of a time for you. So I'm only looking at the amount you're doing going like, dude, I'm so proud of you, but don't push yourself.
It was funny because like at the end of last week I was thinking, man, I wish I did more. I got pretty exhausted by the end of the week.
And that's then content brain, that is.
No, it is.
That's the twitch
it
kicking
is.
In.
It's because we all do like 5 jobs, that's why. And then I kind of realized, I was like, oh yeah, it's been 4 months. In that 4 month period, I've been out with other people probably 4 times cumulatively.
Right.
So coming back into an office full of people doing work on camera, I was like, oh yeah, maybe being in the house, not talking to no one for 4 months might have impacted that a little bit and made it a bit tiring. But
you hadn't missed a step, man.
This enthusiasm that I've got right here that is hopefully coming through is not fake though, because I'm really looking forward to this. And I love doing stuff in here with you.
Thank you. Same. Which is hilarious because we thought we did this last year. I think we did it halfway through the year last year. The totally subjective game of the year ranking, which is a whole thing that only me and you could do in regards to addressing the reality or the assumption of objective fact and quality.
Yeah.
And then throwing it out the window and going, well, actually, what were your 10 favorite? Like, for example, I always ask people if they want to distinguish between the two, what would you say is the best film of all time? And then what would you say is your best? What is your favorite film of all time?
Yeah.
Chances are they're not the same thing. And so when we do, you know, games of the year rankings over on the channel or something more approaching objectivity, there are other measures to take in. Versus, it's fun to just be like, well, actually, what 10 games of last year actually hit your personal top 10? And then maybe it's an Atari game from 1974. I don't know. So
sometimes we record these podcasts for video, Scott Tilford.
Yeah.
In this one in particular, I'm so glad we're not.
So I catch the murder that's going to be on screen.
That's it. Sometimes YouTube comments can be lovely. Sometimes they can't. Sometimes they're not lovely. But I like to think, hopefully, we've created a nice safe space in this podcast. And
just know what you're in for. All the
listening
games
will at least understand. They don't have to agree. But at least understand.
The last one that we did, there's a lot of nice feedback to that. A lot of people really enjoyed the back and forth. There are some ridiculous picks in here. Although at the same time, obviously, I'm going to stand by it. I'm not doing a thing. It's not banter. I do think my top 10 here is very, very solid. And the games are from 2023. Some stuff got remastered. That got re-released in 2023, which reminded me so much of the debate that we had in like 2019 or whatever about Crash Bandicoot being on the top 10.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, that doesn't work at all. But this is my revenge now because I can put a Final Fantasy Pixel remaster in the actual top 10. I did want to say though, and I'll probably revisit this in general, although I do think that like obviously as the turn of the year happens, it's like 2023 feels like ages ago now.
Yeah.
Like the actual new year fireworks and everything feels like ages ago. But yeah, we're going to go back and forward. We've got some honorable mentions and everything else. I just thought it was fun. When I started putting this together, I was like, I'm not even thinking of Mortal Kombat 1 because of how disappointing the end of that game story is. I'm not even thinking about Spider-Man 2 because I only really enjoyed the traversal in that and thought the story was pretty terrible. I'm not even thinking about Sea of Stars because that game's combat was a huge disappointment and the story is a huge disappointment. And I'm not even thinking about Resident Evil 4 because I had a lovely enough time with it, but it doesn't crack my top 10. I do have honorable mentions, but what do you think?
Well, this is why this podcast was the first thing I wanted to do when I came back, because there are so many games that just came out last year generally, but so many that I didn't get to talk to you about. So to find out that you thought the end of Mortal Kombat 1 was so disappointing that it doesn't make the list and you didn't really like Marvel's Spider-Man 2 story, to me, that's selfishly what I'm here for. It's not to reveal my top 10. It's to get your opinions and have those conversations. But I think this might be the most different our top 10 lists of the year have ever been. I don't imagine we'll have much crossover. Even the games that you mentioned there may or may not feature on my list. And I think generally, I don't want to speak for you, but you've said before that, you know, there were a lot of good games last year, but very few that stuck.
Yeah.
I kind of had the opposite experience where this is the first time since I started this job, actually, where the entirety of the top 10 was tough to order. Normally the top 3 to 5 are really tough and everything after that comes quite easily. Here I have a top 10 that I was really worried about in terms of placement, and I have 8 honorable mentions that I'm not going to spend too much time on, don't worry, that could have been in there. And that's like not everything I played. You know, I've left off a bunch of games that I played and didn't think even deserved an honorable mention. Unfortunately, Wolong Fallen Dynasty gets in that bracket.
Who played that?
But in my head, like, I'll stand by, like, last year was I was devouring games and they were devouring me in a really good way.
That was my thing too. I mean, I like to think that I kept up with everything. It was a ludicrous year, like for gaming. Like I went at the end of the year when I totted it up, I'd played, I think it was like 63 games and I'd beaten about 38 of them or something. It was in the 30s that I'd completed. And that was obviously all the big ones and everything else. So it was a big selection. Just super quick honorable mentions. I want to throw in Suika Game into here, which is the sort of physics-based dropper game that released towards the end of the year. That was then on like Famitsu's most important games of last year.
Right.
I remember just getting Suika Game because it was in number one on the eShop and it was like 99 pence or something. And it is a very like addictive, super simple game where you're just dropping pieces of fruit together. And if it's the same type, they morph into a bigger piece and you're trying to get the biggest piece possible on a chart. Super, super simple. And now there's a million clones of it all over the Android store and phone shops and everything. But yeah, Suika Game. I want to shout out Aka R and The Making of Karateka, which are like the Digital Extremes games where they've gone in and they're a lot of of them are like remakes of old stuff from the 70s. Like there's a whole Atari revitalist project going on at the minute, like Atari 50 last year, yeah, before, sorry, 2022, was sitting down with a lot of the key creators of Atari, like just talking through the projects they were on. They were such a big deal for the 70s. And then you can actually play through them like as they're talking about them. And I'm like, that's such a cool thing.
Yeah.
Every single studio needs to do that. Like Last of Us 2 has that with the Lost Levels, like the remaster for Last of Us 2 and the director's commentary and all that kind of stuff. It seems like that's what that's going to be. My other ones were Assassin's Creed Mirage, Cosmic Wheel Sisterhood, Venba, Star Wars Jedi Survivor, and Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom.
Oh, some biggies in there.
Games that like I had a lot of fun with. They were solid enough. They were enjoyable. I love Venba so much. Star Wars Jedi Survivor, I just couldn't sanction it being in the top 10, even though I had a lovely time with it for the most part.
Yeah.
It was just such a broken mess. And then Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom, that game's too close to Breath of the Wild. I don't care how many people try to tell me that it's different enough. It's too close. It's the same structure. It's the same animations across the board. It is the same thing.
Maybe we'll talk more about that in a little bit.
Maybe we will. I still enjoyed it a lot. But
my honorable mentions are the Texas Chainsaw Massacre game, which is the first time I've ever got into an asymmetrical multiplayer game like that. You know, I dabbled in Evil Dead the game, of course. I really enjoyed that.
Well, you could until they shut it down.
That's it. I'm talking, it's what I would describe as a more traditional version of that. Even though you have four villains here against four survivors, it felt more of like a game of cat and mouse, if that makes sense. Really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. Loved Blasphemous 2. Thought that was a really great sequel, though I did have a similar problem that you have with Zelda in that I thought it was a little bit too similar to the original. Mm-hmm. And I've chucked the PSVR 2 in as a whole in my honorable mentions because I thought while if I could put a piece of hardware on my list, that absolutely would get on it. But the lack of first-party exclusives meant that I couldn't single out anything in particular. But I loved my time with that in all of the ports that came over. Mm-hmm. Final Fantasy 16 is on here because...
Oh, my God.
I'm sure we'll talk about this one later on.
Yeah.
But, you know, we did a whole podcast on this that I'll direct people to before we get into the chat proper. I've got a horror game on here called No One Lives Under the Lighthouse, which was a lovely little find for me, very much dabbling in the sort of retro aesthetic horror subgenre that I've enjoyed so much across the past year or so. Really atmospheric, really interesting story-wise. If you're a fan of The Lighthouse, the movie, you'll probably get a kick out of this. Mm-hmm. I've got Dead Island 2 on here because I thought that was just a complete surprise. I wasn't expecting anything from Dead Island 2, but that turned out really well. Mm-hmm. The Dead Space remake, which was solid.
Show.
And one that was really vying for the top 10 place, Dredge. Dredge was amazing.
Oh, Dredge was incredible. I should have had Dredge on mine. I knew there'd be something that came up that, like, because you're going through so many games.
Yeah.
And I was, like, looking back through all my console libraries and everything. And I remember thumbing over Dredge, and for whatever reason, I think it's because of how far back in my mind 2023 now is. I thought that was too old to be included. But no, Dredge is incredible. So I don't have Dredge in my top 10. That is very much an honorable mention. I love my time with that game. We'll go back and forward then, and we'll see how far we get with these. Depends on, we've only got a certain amount of time in this little studio.
We certainly
until we get kicked out.
Turns out there's a lot of wrestling that happens.
Apparently, the weekend I watched some of it, not all of it, but still, yeah, we're gonna get kicked out at some point, so we might end up splitting the podcast into two halves. But my number 10, completely subjective games of the year 2023, is Like a Dragon Gaiden.
Oh.
The man who erased his name,
please tell me more,
is a thing that started as a DLC for Yakuza 7. Obviously that franchise is, like, for the most part, completely embraced its Eastern name. Now it is just Like a Dragon. And this is something, like I said, that started as a DLC. It's a side story. It's what's happened to Kiryu, who's the main character, or was the main character for the first six main games. Yakuza 7, Like a Dragon, switched over to Ichiban Kazuga. And so he's the new main dude. And then in the upcoming Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth, you play as both Kiryu and Ichiban. But the whole thing in Yakuza history, because the games were called Yakuza for 1 to 6, is that Kiryu, he's died multiple times. You've basically got, like, at this point, the whole franchise's tone is, like, this really over-the-top anime, Bollywood, like, approach to action. And it's phenomenal. It's one of my favorite franchises of all time. I've loved it since the very beginning. And so it's one of those things where Kiryu is meant to be dying. He died at the end of Yakuza 6, and then post credits they reveal he's actually still alive. He just faked his death.
Right.
And so in The Man That Erased His Name, it's all about him, and because it was after Yakuza 7's release, it was an excuse to play back as Kiryu again. And it's just the most over-the-top stupid thing, where they make it so that he faked his death by aligning with this group called the Daidoji, and they're like this super, like, Illuminati bunch of Men in Black secret agents, and they give him... I love it so much. They give him a bunch of like spy gadgets, and they like set him to work like under, you know, under the like crime syndicates of the world to go and do their various deeds and everything. He doesn't like that very much, and the way the story pans out is just ridiculous. Because his solution to everything is like he has such a strict moral code, and if you get in the way, he'll just say no, even if there's like a room of people pointing guns at him or something. And he'll find a way to get out of it. Usually, he just punches his way out of it. Amazing. Or whatever. But the fight choreography is brilliant. The team, Ryuga Gotoku Studio, are having so much fun with revisiting Kiryu and being like, you know, there's this dude who's like supposed to be dead. No one knows who he is. There's a hilarious scene where a guy looks straight at him and doesn't know who he is. He's the most famous dude in the entire franchise. Because he has glasses on, it's the Clark Kent thing.
Right.
And it's
okay.
Under those glasses, I can't tell who you are. And it's just so good. And so yeah, I had a lot of fun with that. A lot of it is filler. That's why it's my number 10, because they're bringing back a lot of the mini games and a lot of the like things that you can grind on, like the pocket racing. You can spend ages in this optional fighting tournament that's in there. You have to do some of it for the main story, but you can then choose to just like level up and do more fighting stuff in this tournament and build this sort of like faction crew to like take on to the groups and stuff. There's a lot of things like that where the story won't progress until you've reached another rank in this other side thing. You can tell it was a DLC made into a full game.
Yeah.
But I just think that the cutscene direction, the character writing, no one is written better or more consistently than Kiryu. Like
right.
In gaming history, like he's such a great like North Star for fun, cool writing, and a studio that knows exactly what they've got with him. So I had an absolute blast with Like a Dragon and Gaiden, and I initially wasn't that bothered about it.
Yeah.
Because like I said, they killed him off in Yakuza 5, he came back. They killed him in Yakuza 6, he came back. But if you're gonna keep bringing him back, do it as a super secret agent with one of his gadgets is a Spider-Man gadget. You hold square and you can fire a web out to catch a guy and then fling them around the loop. Like you can summon drones. You can throw an explosive on the ground. Like, it's just, it's all the hard-hitting old-school Yakuza combat that the franchise used to be known for, which is, in a way, even more refreshing because Yakuza 7 was the switch into turn-based, and that's what they're doing going forward.
That was going to be my next question. You read my mind. I was going to ask my memory was failing me because Yakuza 7 was the one where they pivoted into turn-based combat. There have been so many Like a Dragon games that have released over the past few years that, as someone who is not a fan, but as you know, desperately wants to be, it feels so impenetrable.
Because that's huge.
So many spin-offs, so many sequels. And at this point, I kind of don't know what is a true sequel and what isn't. So right. I kept getting confused between the man who erased his name and Gaiden. And then you've obviously got the spin-off Ishin, which released at the start of last year.
Yeah.
There's so much Like a Dragon content, which I imagine is absolutely sensational if you are in that fandom.
Yeah, and the thing is, like Yakuza 7, because they made it all turn-based and you're switching main characters, you can't just start with that one. I know the turn-based will put some people off, and I would wait for Infinite Wealth because that game has a lot more refinements to what makes a good turn-based model. Like my thing with 7 was that the characters were moving around as you were putting inputs in. So you're trying to line up moves and your character might move out the way, or you might charge at someone and an NPC walking across the street will just get in the way or something.
Right.
That would be infuriating. Infinite Wealth seems like it's fixed all that. But yeah, overall, as a nice little, just it's very tight. It's only like 5, 6, 7 hours long.
Yeah.
You can make it, I've made it longer by doing the fighting, the optional stuff, but I imagine if you just mainlined the main story, you could do it in a weekend. But it's just such a cool game.
At this point, I know when we used to talk about Like a Dragon, I think you used to recommend either Yakuza 0 or Yakuza 6 as a starting point.
Oh, not 6. I would have said 0 because that's set before everything. And you play as Kiryu and Majima, who's like the biggest villain in the series. He's like the Joker of Yakuza, Like a Dragon.
Right, right.
But in 0, you play as him and you kind of find out a bit about why he is how he is. So I would go 0, but that has the old combat model. It's like before they changed the physics. It's still fighting. I'm moving my fists there, but still fighting. Or I go with one of the remakes of 1 or 2.
Right.
Yakuza Kiwami, or that is Kiwami 1 and Kiwami 2 are the remakes of 1 and 2. Yakuza Kiwami 2 has the new physics model in.
Yeah.
So like in a way I would just go with 0 or just go with 3. 3 is the one that I first finished because I played 1 and 2 and I didn't play a whole 1 until I played all the way through 3.
I'm getting the idea that they are all good. They're all worth playing.
Oh, dude, they're really, really good. That's why I wouldn't say go with 6, because 6 is probably the weakest one.
You know what? When I was off, I should have just mainlined all of those games. I would have finally had the time to penetrate that series and understand what the hell was going on when you speak these words at me.
It'd be cool if you ever played like just any of them, because they've got such a specific feel.
Yeah.
And like if you play a load of, I wouldn't recommend doing a load of them in a row. I think they work because they're 1 year, 2. It used to be in the past, it was, you know, many years in between the Western releases, didn't line up with the Eastern ones. But now the franchise is so big that we're getting them mostly in time with the East as well. But like, I would just say that like to no, approach, like the way that they do cities and like, you know, all the food is like proper food. Like they have a lot of licensed stuff in there. And it's just like, there's something about taking a little mini vacation in that space every few years that is just lush.
Yeah, you were saying that, I can't remember what the exact city is on the main strip of the city that you get to explore in those earlier games. But weren't you playing that in preparation for you yourself going to Japan to visit that same street?
Totally. Like there's Yakuza or Like a Dragon, it's called Kamurocho. And in real life, it's called Kabukicho. And it's like, I went to that street. I stood under the sign. There's like this massive sign. This is a specific sign. Like a Dragon fans will know exactly what I mean. And like there's a lot of little things that it does the whole virtual tourism thing immaculately well. And it does mean that they reuse a lot of assets in terms of the environment from game to game. But they've stuck with it since the very beginning that it's kind of a signature trait. It doesn't excuse the negatives of doing that. But and some of their stuff does feel like it's tacked on, like Yakuza 6. But when they do it well, it's phenomenal.
Amazing.
Oh, dude, what was your number 10?
My number 10 is Lies of P, a game that came out of nowhere last year for me. Obviously, I was always going to try to play it because it looked so much like Bloodborne. Mm. And anything that looks like Bloodborne means it instantly has my attention. Mm-hmm. But on paper, this thing shouldn't have worked, in my opinion. It's from a relatively new developer, I think. Mm. It's a Souls-like game starring Pinocchio based on the world of Pinocchio. And that just sounds like a mad sort of boardroom cocaine idea that would never actually result in anything good. And as such, when it was coming to the two big Souls-like games coming out at the end of 2023, those of course being Lies of P and Lords of the Fallen, my money was on Lords of the Fallen all the way to be like the game that can stand up against From Software titles. And oh, how wrong I was, because it was Lies of P that came ahead as like the fan favorite darling. And as I was saying last week on the podcast that we did on Game Pass and where Xbox is, I wouldn't have played this if it wasn't on Game Pass day one, but it was. I jumped in and I was so surprised by the amount of quality that was within this game. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, it looks incredible. It's so visually interesting, not just in terms of the hardware going into it and the amount of, you know, horsepower that it has, but in terms of its art design, like this dark funfair world with these twisted automatons and these kind of infected creatures worked way more than I ever thought it would. It has such a rich atmosphere to it that I found myself interested in Pinocchio lore in a way that I never ever thought I would be, but I was.
That was one of the biggest questions with, because I played the demo and last year was when I finally admitted to myself that I'm done with the Souls genre.
I just
I'm done. So I didn't play Lies of P and I didn't play Lords of the Fallen. There were the only two sort of like notable gaps in my resume, I would have said. But that whole Pinocchio thing was such an interesting pivot or an interesting idea to frame a Souls game around. Like there's a lot of that in there.
There's a lot of that in there. Okay. I'm going to spoil the post-credit scenes for Lies of P.
I've heard so much about these.
For the next 2 minutes, right? So just skip ahead a little bit.
Okay.
Because
I won't. But I won't.
You won't, of course you won't. But I need to talk about how mad it is.
Please tell. I want to know everything about this.
The final cutscene of this game teases in a Dorothy from Wizard of Oz either DLC or sequel, right? You see Dorothy's red shoes walk across the map and she does that thing, you know, that she does in Wizard of Oz where she clicks her heels together to get home. She does that. So they're setting up like a cinematic universe, Scott Tilford, that has Wizard of Oz connections.
Lies of A.
In Dorothy. And you know what? That popped me so much in the moment, I would have pre-ordered it. If that was available right then, I'd have gone, you've convinced me so much that madness absolutely works.
I'm just blacked out there. So many people talked about the end of Lies of P and people who had finished it going like, you're not ready. You have no idea. And I was like, what could they have done?
Yeah.
That's great.
It is.
The thing is, over the Christmas or very, very recently, Steamboat Willie came up is in the public domain as well.
Yeah.
Maybe they do a Steamboat Willie one.
Well, you've got a bunch of stuff like that, right? Obviously you had I say obviously as if like anyone watched this movie, but you had a movie last year called, it was called Pooh, Blood and Honey or something.
Did you watch that?
I did not watch that.
Good, good.
It looked atrocious, man. Which was, based on Winnie the Pooh, because that entered the public domain, or at least a version of him did. Mm-hmm. So they did a horror, mature film.
There's already
going to
be a Steamboat Willie one.
Exactly, right? So they're just taking these characters and making like these public domain versions of them. But if the Lies of P team can do that with those characters and accomplish the same caliber of game that they did with Lies of P, I'm all for it because the combat of this thing is silky smooth.
Okay.
It is impactful. It is difficult, extremely difficult at times. But there's so much variation to it that it remains rewarding. Mm. I like the sort of central mechanic that it utilizes, which is you pick up a lot of weapons within the game, but you have so much opportunity to customize your loadout because you can change the handle of weapons from their from the main body of it. So you can swap like the hilt of something, or say like the hilt of a short sword, and put it on like a great club and attach them together. And you'll get different sort of attacks. You'll get different buffs and stuff like that. So the moment-to-moment combat is pretty much what you'd expect from a Souls-like, but the bosses are where this thing shines. And truth be told, you know, I like to think that I've played enough Souls-like games that I'm at least all right at them. I'm pretty good.
I would say you're above the average.
I'm trying to be humble, but
But like in general, whenever we talk about these things, like me or anyone else in the room will have struggled, and you'll have been like second time, first time, like not too bad.
Well, this is the thing: I've played those games to death, and I just know the rhythms of them. So it means that when I jump into a new game, like Mortal Shell, for instance, I have, you know, obviously I'm not breezing through it, but it's not like playing Dark Souls for the first time, they don't have that same level of challenge. But Lies of P's bosses. I had to learn how to play the game in a different way. I had to understand its mechanics and how they differed from Dark Souls or Bloodborne and use its unique features and ideas to take these bosses down. And they were an absolute joy. They were visually spectacular. They were so unique. There were so many different variations and different attack styles and different play styles that I had to utilize to fight these things. And every single time a boss popped up, it was met with either true joy in how outrageous the boss itself was, alongside true despair because I knew it was going to take me about 2 hours to fight it. I think it's an incredible game. If you like Souls-like games, I definitely check it out. And there's a great, is it Joseph Anderson? The YouTuber who did a video on it, which kind of echoes all of my thoughts, especially about the bosses as well, which I definitely recommend you check out because that game just has so many surprises up its sleeve and it was... Oh, man, it's so good.
I feel like in the run-up to it, it was like, this is the Bloodborne we've been waiting for. And I don't know if it was the Pinocchio aspect of it or whatever, but it feel like it fizzled out a little bit once people found out more about it. And then it was like it reviewed well enough. And then it just didn't seem to maintain that level of hype. Like there was a whole thing about like, we're still waiting for a Bloodborne patch for PS5 and that kind of stuff. And so when Lies of P came out, it was like, this is the thing. This, go play this. This is near enough Bloodborne. I don't know like, from your point of view, whether it does scratch the Bloodborne itch enough or whether it does work as like a stand in for what a new gen Bloodborne might have been or something, or Bloodborne sequel kind of thing, obviously without the lore stuff. But yeah, that side of it is, I feel like it kind of became this like hidden gem or this cult classic and the people who have played it absolutely love it. But it, for whatever reason, it didn't blow up. I feel like Lords of the Fallen had more traction than in the end in terms of people just saying, oh, look at this kind of thing.
I think maybe because like we were saying, you know, on paper, it is kind of it's a difficult sell, man. Like it looks so similar to Bloodborne when you watch a trailer that you might just think of it as being like derivative, but worse because it has this Pinocchio layer to it, but there was so much unique to what Lies of P was bringing to the table that I, you know, discovered as I was playing it that made me realize, oh, okay, this isn't just trying to eat from software's lunch. It's taking that formula and doing its own spin on it, which I really appreciated. And I just couldn't believe the scope of it. And like I said, how much variation there was to the game. I think that if you're wanting a classic Soulsborne experience, which I would sometimes characterize as much by their not open worlds but explorable worlds as I would characterize by their combat, you don't quite get that here. Like the levels are big, but there's not a lot of, you know, shortcuts or interlocking areas or anything like that. It's quite a linear game, but if that's the trade-off that was required to get the variety in terms of locations and enemies and encounters, I'm kind of all right with that.
I think as a game as well, as a final execution of an idea, of a vision, it's just good to have. Like the industry is so like caught up in the amount of layoffs that we had and the amount of projects that get greenlit based on this. It's a giant franchise. It has to be this thing. Obviously, there's the Pinocchio element to it, but it's such a unique looking, like new feeling approach to a game that I'm just glad it did well at all.
Yes.
And it's that it's available. enjoyable. Like I said, I played the beta. I thought it was very, very chunky and solid. And I was like, I totally get what this is. I've done too much of this for 10 years now, and I need to step away from that genre for a bit. My number nine is Gravity Circuit, a game that had maybe the soundtrack of the year. Just a phenomenal... I don't spend too long on it because I talked about it in the overall Games of the Year thing last year. But it's like a Mega Man... If Mega Man was Melee, basically, just a super tight side-scroller with really chunky combat. You eventually unlock things like a pile driver. You can grab an enemy and spin around and slam them on someone else. You can grab other enemies and throw them into other enemies. I have such a soft spot for just really tight 2D games. And there's that whole age-old debate on are games just potentially better if they're 2D because there's less parameters to tighten and you can really get to the heart of a really good feeling video game because you can be completely at one with the controls in a way that a 3D space might not let you. I don't fully go with that, but there are so many just immaculate 2D games, and this is one of them. And like I said, the music is just phenomenal. Sadly, it's not on Spotify, but it is on like Bandcamp and YouTube. So I've just sat listening to that all the time. It's just such a great, groovy, stylish game with just the best combat, best 2D combat, I think, of the year, as I looked on the rest of my list. I absolutely loved it.
Was this the one just before I had my break that you said was like really difficult as well? Or was that a different side scroller where I just remember you saying like, I got to this bit last night and it was so tough, but in a good way, not
that might have been what I forget when Gravity Circuit came out, but yeah, it might have been in around about September, but it's on Switch, it's on Steam and stuff, I think, but I played it on Switch, and the final boss, oh my god, that was the hardest thing of the year for me.
Right.
Must have tried about 50, 60 tries. Like, it took it out of me. Like, you know when you have a thing that's so hard where after a while it's like, this is, you're taking my soul now.
Yeah.
Like, I am spending my life force beating this thing. And I just couldn't do it. And after a while, I eventually did it, and I was like, oh my god, I'm so glad to be free of that. I think that, because you spec quite a lot in terms of different power-ups that you get, and you get different armor boosts and stuff like that, and so there probably is a specific combo that you could have done to make it easier. I had what I thought was a decent enough setup. It was just that at some point, the screen is filled with projectiles and different things to avoid, and enemies to kill, that you're trying to thread the needle, which is obviously how these games nearly always go anyway. And for the most part, I'm comfortable with that. But it gets down to a point where it's like, I need to jump here, then kill this, then go here, then do this, and if I am a pixel off, I am dead.
Yeah.
And it's just like that whole thing, can be super rewarding. But that's only the very, very end of the game. And I think you probably could knock it down to easy or whatever. I think there's difficulty levels, I forget now. But still, overall, just as soon as you start controlling it, it's like, oh, this is perfect.
I know you've just gushed about it there. Where does it rank alongside some of the other great 2D or 2.5D side-scrollers that we've had across the past few years?
Prefer it to Super Mario Wonder.
Really? Yeah. Interesting.
And I was looking forward to Super Mario Wonder. Super Mario Wonder, that was another one that I didn't even put on my honorable mentions. It's not that it's a bad game. It's just that it was exactly what I thought it was going to be. And for as much as in Wonder's case, they advertised all these new mushroom powers and you take Wonder Flower powers, you take all those things. I thought they kind of showed everything in the trailers. There wasn't really anything in the main game that blew me away. And it was just a very short levels, like you can argue it's because it's going to be a lot of people's first Mario. They've got the Mario movie. It'll be a whole generation, a whole bunch of kids' new Mario game, and they'll have an absolute blast with it. I know our Michael Sidgwick from the Wrestling Channel is absolutely loving it, and it's not that I don't. It's just that it didn't blow me away enough where I was like, oh my god, you need to see this. If you've seen the trailers, you've kind of already seen it. A lot of those gimmicks come from visuals and not necessarily gameplay changes.
I wasn't intentionally setting you up for that, but I'm pleased I did because it just allows me to jump further into your brain, Scott Hilford.
That was the thing, that was the whole thing with Gravity Circuit, where I was like moment to moment, second to second, I was grinning like a madman.
Nice.
And I was mostly doing that in Wonder, but just not to the same degree. I think Gravity Circuit is just a super tight game. If you like 2D games and the idea of really chunky melee-based stuff, and you can get some charge attacks and projectile things too, it's awesome.
I know you love a soundtrack as well, so I'm glad that's not on Spotify for
I would
you to
play it right now if I could.
My number nine, Scott Hilford, is Amnesia the Bunker.
Oh,
and I kind of want to come straight out the gate and say that in terms of polish, in terms of like mechanical robustness, it's probably not on the same level of some of my honorable mentions, either, even like Final Fantasy 16 or Dead Space or Dredge or anything like that, or Blasphemous 2, which I really enjoyed. But Amnesia the Bunker is one of those games that I jumped into and didn't expect to still be thinking about months and months later. I'm not an Amnesia fan. In fact, having played the original Amnesia Dark Descent years after it kind of got popular, I appreciated what it spawned, but its style of horror just wasn't for me. And as such, I kind of dabbled in the sequels, but never really got into it in a way where I would call myself a true fan of the franchise. Mm. So, jumping into Amnesia the Bunker, which takes a much more gameplay-focused approach to the series by actually giving you offensive capabilities this time, like a gun or a grenade or some flares to actually fight back in a way that you couldn't in previous installments. Mm-hmm. That excited me. The fact that it was set in a World War One bunker where you're facing off against an entity, I just thought that sounded really cool. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, in practice, all of those things ticked every box possible for me. The atmosphere of this underground bunker is amazing. The sound design is incredible. I love the fact that you don't know if a kind of rattle in the next room was the monster or if it was just the impact of shelling on top of the ground that you're under. Mm. I love the way that it kind of plays with your expectations of what to expect from a horror game in that regard. I think the monster design is quite cool. I like the way that you're encouraged to almost play it, at least in my opinion, like a roguelike. Right. You only have one save point in the entire game, which is in your kind of safe zone. And all of the areas sort of spiral out from there. Mm. They're like kind of like tentacles that all weave back to this one area. And the gameplay itself is based around mechanical trial and error, which I love. I love the fact that, for instance, instead of, you know, there are so many ways to take down a door, which might sound strange, but what I mean by that is if you come up against a locked door, it's not like inaccessible. You can blow it up. You can like smash it down, but everything you do in the game has a sort of risk reward element to it. Obviously, if you smash down the door, you're going to make a lot of noise. Mm. Even revving up your flashlight, it works kind of like one of those old lawnmowers or a chainsaw where you have to like pull the chain, but that makes a lot of noise. That's so great. You might alert the monster. And having those trial and error runs of, you know, what is going to work? How can I improvise my way around this area and escape death? Mm-hmm. Was just always so intense. And as someone with an anxiety disorder,
you're steering into it.
I'm steering into it. It was genuinely with that in mind.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I was racked with anxiety playing that game because there's so much you have to think about. Every time you set out from the safe room, you have to make sure there was enough gasoline in the generator to keep the lights on. Otherwise, you're going to see the monster more. You have to, you know, you only have a limited inventory space, so you have to balance the amount of resources you actually take out into the world. And there's so much to consider. It's so tense. And unlike a lot of horror games where once you die, the tension's kind of alleviated and you just kind of become frustrated, this never did for me. And I love the way it escalates as you find new areas and find new items and kind of, like I said, can combine them in interesting ways. I love the fact that you can attack the monster, but it'll get stronger every time it comes back.
Right.
So originally, you can use one of your few bullets to shoot it, but then the next time it attacks you, it'll take two bullets to scare
it off.
That's
a really cool system.
Stuff like that, man, just like makes you think about what you have in your inventory in a way that even some of the survival horror greats like Resident Evil 2 don't quite. And I know it's not going to be for everyone. It's way more of a niche product than any of the other games that I have on my list, probably. But in terms of horror games that I played last year, this one just has stuck with me, and I think about it all the time.
That's honestly, that whole way that you've described it, my throat will not play ball, but the way that you described it when we talked about it earlier in the year last year, I didn't end up getting it. It was on PlayStation Plus for a bit, or on Game Pass. It was on one of the two, and I downloaded it. I still would like to get around to it. I feel like just the way you describe it is awesome. I just can't tell if I'll get annoyed by what I imagine are the Alien Isolation isms of it, where you just get grabbed from behind by the thing, or like you're just about to achieve the next milestone and you get killed, and it's like, okay, do that run again. Going through all the roguelike stuff in like God of War Valhalla, I was like, I think I hate roguelikes for the most part, unless the level itself is also randomized like in Rogue Legacy or to a degree Hades. But if I'm just redoing the same thing over and over again, I think I can get tired of it. That sounds awesome though. And I would, yeah, like I said, I'd like to get around to it eventually. My number eight, well, eventually we'll get a game that we line up on. I think we will when I get to my number seven, but my number eight is Theatrhythm Final Barline, which is a so much Final Fantasy in mind. I grouped some stuff together in this because my top 10 would have just been all the different Final Fantasies that I went through last year. But Theatrhythm Final Barline is the follow-up to the DS, or 3DS game, and it's just a rhythm game based around Final Fantasy music. If you're a Final Fantasy fan, you know about Nobuo Uematsu, you know about the overall audio footprint that Final Fantasy has. It's some of the best music ever written, like regardless of medium. And the ability to just play through all of that was magical. Like, I mean, they have a cool few things in here too. Like, I do think it's obviously very solid as an overall package, but I fell in love with it just as a Final Fantasy fan. Because you make a team of four characters that are just battling underneath the buttons that are on screen, essentially. I couldn't think what you call the tracks that are going along the screen that you would get in a rhythm game. You've got everybody fighting underneath. So if you want to put all your favorite villains or heroes or any mix of anybody together, you can. Graphics don't look great in terms of the character models and everything. It's very, very simple, but it totally does the job, and they have all the official recordings and everything. Over time, Square Enix have put more in there, like Nier Automata soundtrack is in there, and various other Square Enix games are in there. But for the most part, it just is this Final Fantasy archive. And as someone who's played through, obviously, like back in the day, like 7 through 10 and then 12 and whatever, 13, 15, everything else, going, like there's all those soundtracks, but then going through the pixel remasters, I would go through a pixel remaster, love it, and then I would go on Theatrhythm Final Barline and play through all the music for it.
Oh, I love
and it's
that.
Just, that was just a 1-2 for all those games where I was like, I'm in such a bubble with Final Fantasy. And it made me realize across all of last year that I just do not get sick of that franchise. It's always been one of my favorites, but I'm currently going back through Final Fantasy X again.
Again.
I just cannot get enough of the whole thing. So that's all I need to say about Theatrhythm Final Barline, but if you're a Final Fantasy fan, it's a bit off-putting how much the price is. It's they're pricing it very premium because it's Square Enix. I traded a bunch of games in to get it. but if you're a Final Fantasy fan, there's so much here to just go, oh my God, they included that. Oh my God, I can play through this. It's beautiful. And like, yeah, all the remixes of songs are in there from over the years. Advent Children stuff is in there from the movie. For Final Fantasy VII, but you obviously have all the original games and everything else. They also did a Final Fantasy 16 add-on pack, which is gorgeous. 16's nice. Music is otherworldly good. So that's all I'll say about Theatrhythm, unless you have any questions.
No, I was just going to say that one of my favorite things last year to share with you was your Final Fantasy
step into this bubble with me, bro.
Journey. Yeah, it was, man. It was great to see your enthusiasm for it. It was great to watch you play through all of those games and recommend them and say why you love them. Goals. And you went to see the orchestra as well, right? The live orchestra.
I had such a year of Final Fantasy. I was telling Final Fantasy 16's Ben Starr about this. what I ran into with the golden joysticks. Golden joysticks?
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't think. There's so many golden thingies that have been out. I was lucky enough to run into him. And a massive shout out to Ben Starr. Dude was the loveliest man ever. And knew our work and knew me, which blew me away. So shout out to that dude. But yeah, I had this overall year of Final Fantasy. I was lucky enough to go to Japan and go to the Final Fantasy Cafe. Saw the Final Fantasy Orchestra, Distant Worlds. Met Ben Starr, which was ridiculous. Played Final Fantasy 16. And then played through a bunch of the Pixel remasters and Theatre Rhythm Final Barline. Ludicrous.
What a good year.
Ridiculous year. It was absolutely gorgeous. But yeah, that was my number eight.
My number eight is The Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom. Ooh. And it's, you know, we did that really long podcast way back when this game launched. Mm. And we had a lot of criticisms. And I still have a lot of criticisms about the game and things that just didn't click with me. But when I think about my time with it, I did really enjoy it, and it's only because the bar was so high and because Breath of the Wild blew me away so much. It sold me on Nintendo as a company. It sold me on the
Nintendo
Switch.
Slander.
It sold me on Zelda as an IP, made me want to play all of those games. It made me love Skyward Sword because of the residual enjoyment that I had from Breath of the Wild.
Yes.
So that bar was almost impossible to meet. You only get to play a franchise for the first time once, and when that entry point is as good as Breath of the Wild, you're pretty much going to be chasing that high ever since. So with that in mind, I still think The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom was an absolutely exceptional game. Like I said, I had my problems with it, including how I thought the hardware itself was pulling the game back in terms of visual splendor or knocking me out in the same way that the original did. But the things that it does mechanically with the physics within the world itself, I have no idea how they pulled that miracle off and managed to not just break everything.
Uh-huh.
I liked the new temples that you got. I thought the story was really good. I liked the changes they made to Hyrule, and I loved the depths. The depths was probably my favorite part about the game because it was
my least favorite part.
For whatever reason, it clicked with me. It felt like new original content. Mm. It gave me the same thrill I got with Breath of the Wild, that I was exploring a new unknown area and that there were surprises around every corner. Mm-hmm. I do want to go back and spend more time with it because I put 50, 60 hours into it, finished the main story, of course, but I still feel like I have some unfinished business with it in a way, and I wonder whether I do go back to it in a year's time. Will I look back on this list and think, oh man, you probably should have given that a fairer shake. Not a fairer shake, but you know what I mean.
I know what you mean.
Put it a little bit higher.
Yeah, my thing with Tears was just I couldn't shake how much Breath of the Wild was in it. And I did love the Skylands. I love the depths. I love the main story. Like, I did really enjoy a lot of my time with it. It was just that I couldn't, that objectivity side of it kind of seeped in a bit too much for me, where I just couldn't shake, like, oh, those are the same animations. Those are the same sound effects. I'm getting the Korok seeds again. Like, I'm going to the same areas. I'm going to the corners of the map again. Like, I'm getting the same armor to withstand the fire in the fire level again. That bled through too much, where it made me just feel like I do largely side with the people who, in the best intentions possible, say it feels like a DLC. And I almost feel like it was just that I couldn't necessarily shake that. It's not that the things that they do add to it aren't great. I love the Sky Islands. The depths I had fun with to a point, but after a while I was like, oh my god, I'm sick of the pitch black of everything. I just want to get through this area. I'm spending the time building cool little vehicles, and then I fall off a cliff I can't see, or whatever it is. And that kind of got annoying after a while. But yeah, the thing that they achieved by turning the entirety of an open world into one big dungeon is phenomenal. And like, obviously they haven't necessarily done, I'm trying to think off the top of my head, they haven't necessarily done physics-based puzzles too much in the past, where it actually has like free-form physics. Like, you're rolling something somewhere, or you're interacting with levers and things like that. But I love the overall idea of like, what is the lifeblood of Zelda? And like the lifeblood of, like, you go back to that original game of just this open space that you're going to figure out, and which item works with which door. And like, oh, if I burn this tree, it actually burns away and there's a staircase and I can go down there. Like, they did that back. They brought that back in Breath of the Wild, which is really cool. And then they double down on it in Tears of the Kingdom, which I love. Like, I love that overall ethos of, you take a, you know, like a 35-year-old IP. I think it's more than that. I can't think off the top of my head now, maths, but it's quite an old IP.
Yeah.
And then being able to channel those things and be like, no, this is what it is. It's a puzzle-based, figure-it-out kind of game. And it doesn't need to be as sort of straightforward as a lot of the games in the middle have been. And so I definitely appreciate all that stuff. It was just that I couldn't shake how much it felt like I was playing the 2017 game again.
Nope, and I get that as well. You know, fortunately, I was in the mood for more of that because I obviously played so much Breath of the Wild back in the day, but I haven't touched that since 2018, probably. Right. So a lot of the stuff that was repeated felt fresh to me just simply because of the fact that I'd forgotten that it was there to begin with, especially some areas of the map where when I was doing direct comparisons, I was like, okay, that is much closer than I thought it was. Like I said, I have my criticisms, but I thought the dungeons, like the main dungeons themselves, were still better than Breath of the Wild, but still
disappointing. I think the altered content's better,
to me, it's definitely better, but I would have liked a little bit more. And a part of the issue I have with it is definitely a me problem, and that's that I don't have the imagination for a game like this. I get the same issue with immersive sims sometimes, where I'm let down because once I figure out an optimum route to accomplish my goals, I'll just do that over and over again. Right. So I made a lot of, you know, balloon rockets that just got me to where I needed to be, and I didn't need to improvise in another way, and I kind of wish I could shake that part of myself because there's so much you could accomplish within that sandbox, but in a way I kind of ruined it for myself because I just kept doing the same thing over and over again.
I think I said this when we did our big spoiler cast thing, but I view that as an issue with the game because, like, one of the things that happened with Tears of the Kingdom was it went massively viral for the amount of the huge mechs you can make. You can't build them in the Switch version. All that's, you can, but like it's going to take 50, 60, 80 hours of just unlocking the Zonai charges to have enough power to build something that's that big. A lot of those things came from the leaked version or the hacked version that was on PC. And it's like, I kind of always thought that, you know, when games get a build mode, like Teardown has a build mode and Minecraft has a build mode. And like, it's not that I wanted that necessarily in Tears of the Kingdom, but they had so much scope where they worked out all these really cool physics systems. But I would hazard a guess that most people playing it didn't actually build a crazy, big, ridiculous thing. They took a plank of wood and put four wheels on it. Or they, you know, like they put a rocket on a shield and flew straight up. Like, I think the game could have done so much more with encouraging you to do those crazy things and give you the ability to do it. Like, unless you keep checking in with that one guy that's north of the central hub to get more Zonai stuff, and unless you're you know, exploring the depths to even realize how to do that, you can miss out on what is the best part of that game. And even then, like I said, like you can get all the way through the main missions without even needing that stuff. There are only certain puzzle solutions that require a level of like, I'm going to build this to like float this thing over a ledge or whatever, and you can get around it a different way too. That's both the biggest positive and the biggest negative.
I
kind of wish they encouraged you to actually use all that stuff a lot more.
I know what you mean. You know, like I felt immense satisfaction where I would create a flying death machine raining down absolute carnage on the enemies below. And I also felt a major sense of satisfaction where I solved a puzzle in like a unique way, kind of like how I did with Breath of the Wild. But I think going forward, for me personally, Zelda fans may not want this, but I would love to see those mechanics return in an entirely new open world, double down on them, really design missions around using them, keep that sense of verticality, and just push me, Josh Brown, more to improvise in new and different ways rather than relying on the same old tricks. But that might be impossible. Maybe that's just the way my brain's wired.
No, I think it's on them to bring that stuff out of you. Like, if they need to think of ways that would tease that out of you. Some of the best games should give you new thought processes that you didn't have when you were going in. I'm sure, I don't know if they have the exact quote in front of me, but I'm sure Eiji Inuma said the next Zelda wouldn't be like this. I think they said they want to return to something a bit more traditional or whatever. But you have to imagine they would learn from this. Like, it's just the traditional Zelda, like, I mean, there's a few different identities to it over the years, but you still have that standard thing that Ocarina of Time, I mean, well, it goes back further than that, but Ocarina of Time was so big that became what people think of when they think of Zelda. And I would say that something like Skyward Sword was the absolute breaking point of that, where it was just tedious. Like, fly back over here and get this one item and then fly all the way back over there and do another thing. Whereas you want to gamify the in-between, which is what Breath of the Wild and Tears did. So you have to imagine they would learn from all that and make this perfect Zelda, where you're like, you know what you want to aim for, but you can do cool things on the way there. I think there's a way that they can do that.
When your child is 7 years old, we'll see if they actually accomplish that.
Oh my god, that's the terrifying thing, is that I guess there'll be the next Nintendo system will be out by the time my kid wants to play that stuff. So we'll see. That was your number 8, I believe.
It was.
Number 7, Alan Wake 2, my friend.
Oh, interesting. thought that was going to be on your list, but genuinely thought it was going to be a little bit higher.
It would be if the story wrapped better.
Oh!
If the story was better, if it wasn't so just magical realism, surrealism, we haven't actually written this, we're just going to kind of rely on these other things and hope you fill in the blanks storytelling, then I'd be more with it. But if I'm getting subjective AF, I didn't like the way that story went at all. I didn't like that they rely so much on Mr. Scratch, a character from a DLC from the first game that most people haven't played, and they don't flesh him out in Alan Wake 2. They just don't do enough to make the stakes work in that story.
Interesting, yeah. Man. Did you do a spoiler cast on this?
Me and Strawn did, yeah.
I'm going to go listen to that tonight. I am fascinated by that. That is really interesting, especially when you talk there about the sort of surrealism and magical realism and how much it leaves to your imagination. I'm going to shock you, Scott Tilford. I wish it left more to my imagination. I wish it left a few more mysteries. There are, of course, ones in there, but it does something towards the end of the game in a post-credit sequence that I thought could have done without that. You know what I mean? Right. I wish it was a little bit more ambiguous in that way, but that's fascinating, especially coming off the original, which
was way
more ambiguous, I thought, but maybe you
The thing is, like, the thing with these games, the thing with Remedy over the years is that they've increasingly, like, you're writing these stories that are set in specific worlds and specific contexts with specific rules, and you're telling me about the rules. You have characters explaining, like, oh, well, this is the dark place. This is the, you know, you use the flashlight to use the light, and the light repels the dark place, and, like, these different fractured personalities, and that's where this person is. And, like, that whole idea of, like, oh, they're actually physically under the water, but they are stuck, or whatever it is. Like, there's just these different approaches to trying to convey stakes. And overall in media, like, if you're attempting that, then go all the way with it and let me get invested in the rules and the stakes. If you're to the other side, if you're going completely surrealist or interpretational or whatever, more Lynchian, I guess, then that's also fine. But I find that the line that Remedy have increasingly walked with Control and now this is this weird hodgepodge where they want to have a bunch of rules for their universe, like what they brought in Control, and they want to have the FBs, the Federal Bureau of Control, and they want to have all this, like, it all makes perfect actual sense. Mm. And they tell you, like, oh, the events of Alan Wake 2 is actually inside a bubble. Like a literal bubble, and that's why everything's distorted. And I'm like, you put that in there to explain exactly what's happening.
Right.
But then at the same time, you're relying so much on the dark place, and, like, there are more than one Alans. Like, there's the Mr. Scratch, and it's, like, his evil side or whatever. But Mr. Scratch himself is a character from, like I said, a DLC from the original game that they don't really flesh out. He just puts a jacket on at one point, and he starts killing people.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, fine, but, like, what is this? Is the real him, his actual body still underwater? Because we explained that before. Like,
yes.
It's just a whole thing. And I just, more towards the end, I thought it started really leaning on that, oh, we'll just go with it kind of mentality, which comes through in a lot of movies and things like this, where it's like, well, you're having fun. It's the right vibe. Just go with it. Like Record Scratch in Death Stranding 2 or Death Stranding 1.
Yeah.
And it's like, after a while, I was like, I don't care anymore. Mm. And then the whole, like, it's not a loop, it's not a thing, it's a spiral or whatever. And I was like, yeah. Like, I get that this whole thing is kind of about the, you know, sort of collapsing mentality of a writer who's obsessed with their work. Like, that is obviously the overall framing of it. But I didn't really get much out of it.
Interesting.
And it was like, other than the vibes, I think it's immaculately put together. I'm obviously focusing on the negatives because we're doing a subjective list. I still think it's incredibly well put together. And in terms of what were they going for, what did they nail, they largely did that. It's just that for me and my wife, when we played through it, we were both just like, I just have no stakes in the back third because it's just all over the place. And then, yeah, like when it wrapped, I was like, yeah, sure. Okay.
That's fascinating, man. I'm not surprised, especially because we've talked about similar games before and probably landed on either side of this coin already. I guess I'll talk about it now. I won't reveal where it lands in my list because that'll be a time for part two, but I might as well talk about it now rather than split the discussion.
We will do up to number sixes and we'll do the top five next week.
Great. But so Alan Wake 2, I liked for pretty much all of the reasons that you didn't like it there. To me, as someone who is perhaps clichédly a big David Lynch fan, I loved how much this echoed Twin Peaks The Return, which was the third season of Twin Peaks, which came 25 years after the original. And like Twin Peaks The Return, I just thought Alan Wake 2 was this kind of like darker, more menacing, more twisted version of a kind of more romanticized previous installment, if that makes sense. Obviously, the original Alan Wake had a lot of darkness to it. It had a lot of, you know, horror within it, but it also, the stakes to me weren't as high in that game, whereas I, funnily enough, thought Alan Wake 2 brought a sense of grit and edge to the surrealism that I really appreciated. I really felt for characters that I never thought I would. You know, like Alice Wake, I was so invested in her story.
I like what they did with her, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, Saga I thought was incredible. I thought the best...
I thought Saga was empty.
Well, oh, man.
She's barely a character to me.
The best compliment I could give the game, right, is that in a game called Alan Wake 2, which I've been waiting for 10 years to continue the story of the titular Alan Wake, I was more interested in Saga's
interested, but I didn't think they paid it off.
Ah, man. See, I thought, I love what they did with her and Alex Casey, all the intertwining plot lines, and I loved where they ended it initially, again, before that post-credit sequence. I just thought it tied everything up really nicely. I love the way it plays with the tropes of horror like the original did. And I do just love that sense of like nastiness that the game had to it. And I guess I can alleviate some of the negatives you had by the comparisons that I would make to something like Twin Peaks, because similarly, the villain in Twin Peaks, Killer Bob, you know, is similar to Mr. Scratch in that he's almost kind of unknowable. He is just like the sort of entity of darkness and violence and stuff like that. So it worked for me in that regard, and I got a lot out of it, not just from the vibes, but interpretively as well, which we don't have time to get into but you know, I just felt like there was a lot of meat to the bone.
No, there is. It's just that it's very subjective meat. But I think we'll revisit Alan Wake 2 because I imagine it's in your top five.
It absolutely is.
So we should talk a bit more about it like next week, because like, yeah, we haven't even talked about the combat. I thought the combat was abysmal in parts, so it's like there's that dragged it down for a bit too. I'm not even talking about the positives, even though I had it in my top 10 at number 7. There was a lot of stuff that I still love the writing. I love the whole music dance sequence that's in there. I love how much they just, I love how confident Remedy are in 2023, 2024. They have just seized a certain vibe and they have all the money to put into it. And that was the main reason that I came away just absolutely loving it. In terms, like, overall, even though I do have big issues with the story and the feel of like the stakes and then some of the light puzzles, I think sucked. Like there's just things like that where I can't, if I'm going to be completely subjective about it, then it makes me go like, well, I hated playing that and I hated that reveal and that cutscene sucked and like I'd really, oh, that took me out of it and like, oh, I thought you were going there but actually you did that and that's so much worse and whatever. And like after a while I was like, it has a full package totally, but there's so many negatives to it as well.
Conflicting feelings here, because one, I'm so pleased,
I'm in the dark place, Jeff.
I'm so pleased you have done a spoiler cast because I get to listen to it and I get to talk to you more about this as soon as we stop recording. But on the other hand, I'm so gutted I wasn't there for that spoiler cast.
That's the thing. Me and Strawn did the, Adam Strawn over on the main channel, me and him did the Alan Wake 2 spoiler cast pretty much fresh after we'd both finished it. So I had a lot of different thoughts there. And I imagine I'm more positive on that spoiler cast. You'd think I'd remember because it's my head, but I don't. And at the minute now, I always have that negative edge to it. But yeah, it's like reflecting back on it. Yeah. It's like, I appreciate it. I'm glad it exists. But it's impossible to recommend. Like, you'd have to play Alan Wake 1 and then do American Nightmare and then probably play Control and then you could play Alan Wake 2.
That's so funny because I've been recommending it to everyone I know who doesn't even play games.
That's really?
Yeah,
I think
you'd
be so lost in it.
I think you would, but I think you could pick it up. For me personally, you know, I think there's enough in there for you to get it. Not the Control stuff. I'll admit that. Like, you won't get the connections to Control. They're only in there for people who actually played that game.
Yes.
But I don't know. I thought it worked. I thought it worked.
It did many things. So that was my number 7.
My number 7 is Marvel's Spider-Man 2.
Interesting.
And like my previous pick, Zelda Tears of the Kingdom, this is a game that I could genuinely pick apart and criticize in a loving way for probably about 3 hours. I could sit you down in this podcast room and talk about everything that I think could have been better, I didn't necessarily like, but like something like Zelda or God of War before it, that kind of comes from a place of love. And it's weird because I think sometimes you can criticize things you love more than you can criticize things you hate, because the flaws as they are become so much more obvious, I suppose, when anything else is spectacular. Mm-hmm. So I do have my problems with Spider-Man 2, but the overall feeling that it left me is this was a damn good sequel. Right. And everything in there, I watched this really good video on it from a channel I think called High Top Films, who went into the story specifically, and I echo what they said about it, and that is the story is overstuffed. Any one of the major threads in this game could be its own game and could be fleshed out way more than it is. But that's not to say that what's in there isn't spectacular in its own right, in my opinion. I thought all of the threads were presented well. I just selfishly wanted more of them. I wanted them to be fleshed out a little bit more. I wanted to see a bit more character depth here and there. I wanted things to be allowed the time to breathe and not feel as quickly ran through. But, you know, if we're talking individual moments, I love the entire stretch where Peter is Venom and you're controlling Mary Jane and it kind of goes horror-focused. I love the end fight with Venom and himself being the big winged version. Spoilers, sorry, but I just spoiled the entire thing there.
I think a winged Venom is very much got out there.
Venom is definitely out there. I won't spoil what happens to him, but winged Venom is out there. That was amazing. I thought they could have done way more with Venom's plot. I thought that was incredibly underbaked, my maybe biggest criticism of the game. But yeah, just it was one of those stories where I was on the one hand disappointed with how predictable it was, but on the other hand excited because it was presented so well and, for my money, maintained the Insomniac heart that drove the original. It's not as emotionally engaging as the first one, but as far as sequels go, you know, like similarly to Zelda as well, it had this high bar to match for me personally, and it didn't quite smash it, but it did a damn good job at trying.
I loved moving in this game. Like the best movement of the year, best movement of all time, best traversal system in Spidey history. Something that I was looking forward to them like iterating on after 2018 Spidey, because like I liked that game enough. It was just obviously you're taken from Arkham in terms of the combat, but it did differentiate itself enough in terms of how athletic it was. But I always loved the physics-based swing of Spider-Man 2 on the PS2, and I love on this one how you can turn that on. Like it's in the options. I hate that you've got to go into the options and do it.
Right.
Because that'd make that F's with my artistic brain where I'm like, well, you guys didn't want us to do this or something. And I'm just like, just design the swinging system that we're supposed to use as default. And then I'll critique that or I'll analyze that. But I ended up like turning that almost all the way off. I think I did turn it all the way off because then you can actually hit the ground.
Yeah.
And it's like, unless you're getting your swings right, and that unlocks more speed and you have to get the actual like arc of the swing right. That's what being Spider-Man should feel like. And that wasn't in the 2018 one for me. It was very floaty. And it's like when you dive off a really tall building and then you catch yourself at the last minute, that should be a lightning quick fling forward that wasn't in 2018 but is in Spidey 2. So I loved being Spider-Man. That's why I like hoovered up the platinum and everything. It wasn't even on my honorable mentions because I just got so sick of everything other than the traversal.
Right.
I thought the story I thought was really bad. Like I said, predictable. I thought the actual Harry swerve was terribly handled and really forced and really quick and bad. I hated anything where I wasn't playing as the Spider-Man. I was just like, what are we doing? Why am I running around a construction site spray painting? What is that? What is that? Like, I hated that. And I get obviously what they're going for in terms of the, identifying with a different character. And look at, the thing is though, like, I like that on paper, the idea of like, look at the street level of what a Spider-Man can bring to a person or a group, what Miles represents, and then the wider, almost intergalactic stuff of a symbiote invasion that Peter Parker can do. Those together are really good ideas, but it just didn't land for me at all. It felt like this really, especially by the end, this big rush job, because the symbiote invasion was handled like overnight. And it was just, you didn't even see the police forces responding to it or NPCs responding to it or anything.
That's interesting.
The city didn't really respond to the fact there was an alien invasion happening. I just thought it was so undercooked. And then obviously there's the stuff with Tony Todd talking about he recorded way more that they didn't use. And there's the whole bit where Venom swings away and Peter goes after him and then we cut and we don't actually get that scene. Tony Todd on another tweet, I did a whole article about how disappointing it was because he talked about there's a showdown between Venom, Miles and Peter. And that wasn't in the game. So I'm like, well, I guess you guys cut that then. And just things like that where it was so threadbare by the end just to get it over the finish line.
Right.
I have so many thoughts on Sony's handling of Spider-Man.
And right. I think that
this is one of the biggest casualties of their overall business plan.
That is extremely exciting. Funnily enough, disagreed
with Spider-Man.
With what you said there about it's funny. It's a classic me and you situation where I agree overall with your thoughts on how the symbiote invasion is handled. I do think it's too rushed, but I would disagree with what you described as not seeing the response on the ground, because that's the one part of it that I really did like, that the fact that when you're swinging around in that period, the encounters on the ground change and you have like these big fights between symbiotes and then the gangs and you kind of swing in the middle and you have to take them on. I don't know, maybe I would just enjoyed the surprise of that so much and how dynamically it did change the city that it sold me on that invasion aspect more in a way that slightly made up for the lack of cutscenes surrounding it, especially when you throw into like the Jonah podcast always talking about it as well and how it's like the end of days and stuff.
Yeah.
That admittedly did work for me, but I will agree that that story overall is rushed. It has a lack of explanation. You know, I wish there was more lore to what was happening, because I feel like if you've not read the Venom arc that that's from, you might be a little bit lost and it might feel a little bit lacking in depth. But for me, I loved the Harry stuff up until his predictable turn. I thought they did an incredible job of making you care for him straight away. I know some people don't agree with that. I was talking to Adam Nicholas about it, and he hated Harry from the get-go.
I'm way more towards Nicholas than you.
Really?
Yeah. I just didn't... It was just because it was so forced, and it was like that bit when you go around the carnival with him. Again, why am I not playing Spider-Man? Why am I not doing Spidey things? Here's some mini-games, because we're a Sony game.
That's hilarious, right? Because I was playing that bit with my girlfriend, and we were saying, like, I bet some people hate this. And that was like our favorite part of the game. You know what I mean? Because I can just go to
a festival.
Not with Harry Osborn, you can't.
I don't want to be with him. He sucks.
Well, that's the difference, right? I was surprised at how likable and
I didn't hate him, to be fair,
I was endeared to him early on, because honestly, going into it, I thought, another Harry storyline. Mm. How many times have I seen this in comics and films and television shows? You know what I mean? How many times have I seen these beats play out? But there was just something about, I can't remember the actor's name, but his performance as Harry and the model that they use, he just looks like a cheeky chappy.
He looks like Dave Mustaine. He looks like the singer of Megadeth, yeah.
I don't understand that reference, but I'm going to have to Google it after this.
Dude looks just like Dave Mustaine.
But yeah, the point is, like, they did a good job endearing me towards him to the point where I was like, okay, I guess I can go for another Peter and Harry story. I liked the moments where you didn't play as other characters. You know, I defended those in Spider-Man 2018, and then in retrospect, when I played that game again for the remastered version of PS5, I thought, oh no, these do detract. You know, I loved playing as Miles in theory. I love playing as Mary Jane in theory, but the stealth there didn't work.
How tight is Miles Morales as a game? The 2021?
Yeah.
Because it gets rid of all the fat.
Well, he's where the butt was going to come in. I liked it in Marvel Spider-Man 2 because I thought it was actually enjoyable to play. Right. I like third-person shooter Mary Jane sections. I thought they were really good.
It's because we're grouping them all together. It's like the one when you're on the construction site and you're doing the spray paint thing and you've got to do the puzzle where you move the lift so you can go up to the roof. That sucked.
Right.
MJ stuff I thought was better than in the 2018 one. I'm glad they gave her a gun and a takedown animation. It just reminded me too much of, like, how do we crowbar The Last of Us into this? Because it was just like the overall look of all those areas was just Last of Us.
Right.
And it was like, I feel like ever since The Last of Us in 2013, it's like obviously Naughty Dog became the North Star, whatever, for Sony development overall. God of War got a Last of Us-ing of itself. And now it was like, how do we get that bit of that signature style in there?
Yeah.
That conversation might have not happened at all, but like it felt like that. It felt like I'm crouching behind an enemy. I'm going to take them down in a moss-covered environment to remind you that it's a Sony first party
game. Right, yeah.
And I was just like, I don't need this. And also, if you get seen, then you'll kicked right back to the start again.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, we have instant fail stealth in 2023. Oh, what are you doing?
That is true.
And it was just like that, little things like that where I was like, oh my God, these other gameplay tenets are terrible on the same scale as your traversal and the Spider-Man stuff, which is why I'm here in the first place. And it was like, if all I'm, and I don't necessarily hate the MJ stuff, it's just so boring and basic. We've done it a million times and we did it in 2003.
I would disagree, because of course I would. I think, yes, it is a step down, but I thought they were more on par this time around. I get that people just want to beat the Spider-Man and they want to do the superhero stuff, but for me, getting that on-the-ground perspective adds a lot. And
it does, especially
when you get sequences like Scary Peter chasing
That's
her,
the best one.
It justifies itself for me.
Well, sorry.
No, go on. I was just going to say there were more of those for me than there were the kind of, I'll agree, monotonous spray paint ones, even though I love that character.
I was going to say, I defended the one in 2018's one when you're playing as MJ in Central Station. Central Station? And you'll have Spidey's coming down, taking some goons out, and you're going around. Because like you said, that fundamentally bolsters the idea of the duality of their relationship, or like what Spider-Man can bring to someone on the ground. It was just that they did too much of it where it detracted.
Yeah.
I wasn't even thinking down the line of like, oh, MJ doesn't even need Spider-Man, until I started seeing all the backlash online. The conversations online of like, how capable is MJ? She doesn't really need Spidey.
Yeah.
She can just take out a whole army of goons. I was like, oh, I guess so. Yeah.
I did laugh when they were like, right, MJ, you go into the symbiote nest. Like, that's the most, like, dangerous job anyone could ever have.
There's
like,
when she jumps in front of Spider-Man. I was like, it's Spider-Man.
I wouldn't entrust Spider-Man with going into the symbiote nest without, like, him and Miles. I thought that was a little bit funny. But I liked that she was involved. And
yes,
I did like that section from a gameplay perspective, absolutely.
There's so much to talk about with that game, because I was groaning most of the time. But we'll dive back into
it. Can I have a few more seconds just yes. to talk about 2 points quickly before yes. we wrap up, if that's okay. Because I do want to point out something that you always talk about, and that's the marketing of the game. Mm. I do think that let it down a little bit. It made the same mistake as the first game did. And I remember saying to you, you were asking me if I'd watched the latest Spider-Man trailer after the reveal. Well, my voice went strange. The reveal where you're chasing down the lizard as the symbiote. Mm. And I said, no, because I don't trust them to not reveal too much after they reveal yes. The raft segment in the initial game. And even by then, I'd already seen too much. I didn't need right. to see Peter in the symbiote costume. I didn't need to see him chasing down the lizard. I just don't know why they need to reveal those big set pieces. And it's funny, I was watching an interview with Brian Inatar, the creative director on Kind of Funny Games, and he was saying about how he didn't want to show anything. He was like, I don't want to show anything from this game. You know, it's Spider-Man 2, it'll sell. And obviously, he had to compromise. And I'm like, no, you're right. Like, don't show stuff from that far in the game. Like, in my opinion, it only led to those expectations, like you were saying, that we were going to get to the symbiote suit much quicker. We were going to get to Venom much quicker. And I wish I hadn't seen that. I wish they marketed it in a slightly different way and set those expectations down. Secondly, I do want to shout out some positives because I feel like I've been shouting about it for so long. But again, it comes from a place of love.
Yes.
From the first act, I thought I was in for maybe the best game I had ever played. I know we differ on this, but I love the stuff with Sandman at the beginning. I love the scale of that. And more importantly, I loved the moment where both Miles and Peter are in school because Peter's got a job as his teacher. And then they obviously have to go and do Spider-Man things, but then they get back to the school and Miles has missed his appointment and Peter's been sacked. I thought that's Spider-Man yes. right there. You know, I thought that duality of dealing with being a hero and being a normal person was just summed up so perfectly in that scene. And I wanted to see that carried through. Kind of wasn't because there's so much to get through in the game, but those moments kept me coming back. The traverse, like you said, incredible.
Unbelievable.
It looks great, I think. I was playing it on quality mode. I'm not sure if you were in performance. But quality mode was absolutely stunning. There were so many times where I saw the sunset and I was on top of a building and I could see incredible detail below, the ray trace reflections bouncing off the water, and I was just, me and my girlfriend kept saying, I can't believe video games look like this. You know, I was just blown away by it. So hopefully I've managed to do it some justice there. There's so much more I like about it, but we are unfortunately running out of time.
For now, but we can always revisit Spider-Man 2 in general. There are many things I would talk about, but yeah, obviously there are massive positives to it. It still made the overall Game of the Year list that I put together at the end of last year. It's still very much a well-put-together package. I just agree with the people, and I'm one of them, who had a lot of problems with the story or like certain aspects of which parts were made playable, etc. For now, though, this has been the wind-up. Don't think I did an introduction, but I'm Scott Tilford. That's Josh Brown.
You don't think you did? Always a pleasure, Scott Tilford.
Always a pleasure to be joined once again by you and everyone else listening at home. We'll catch you very soon.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.